Hey, everybody. Welcome to The One. This is Greg Gutfeld. Had a week off last week, and here I am back. I got a great guest. He's attorney and author John Yoo. He is currently the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Previously, John Yoo served as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel for the Department of Justice during the George W. Bush administration. But he's here to talk about this great book. I think Dana Perino suggested it to me. It's called Striking Power by John Yoo and Jeremy Rabkin. And it's about how cyber, robots, and space weapons are going to change the rules for war. It's pretty interesting stuff. I enjoy this kind of these kind of books, and I end up marking the hell out of them. Professor Yoo, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, even all the way from the left coast here in Berkeley.
I know. Hey, my alma mater. That's where I'm from.
Oh, we got to have you back.
Yes.
We need another riot.
Yes. When did you graduate? You didn't go to Berkeley, though, right?
No, I didn't go there, but I've been here for since 93.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. That's funny. So, I graduated in 87, so I missed you. And I don't really go back much. I went back, believe it or not, I did go back to speak there. And I don't know when it was, maybe 2009. And it was before the five, and I was doing Red Eye. So the only people that showed up were really hardcore Red Eye fans. And there were like 150. It was pretty cool. And it was on spring break. So it was pretty mild.
Well, we'd love to have you back if you want to do a live taping of your podcast out here in Sproul Plaza.
That would be
fabulous.
No, thanks. Hey, I want to ask you, your book is about weapons and modern weaponry, and I want to start with this horrible event that happened in Las Vegas. And I'm looking at it, and I immediately thought about this is how it's going to be. There's always this learning curve where terrorists see an event, see how it works, and they adapt. And I know that also Scott Adams has talked about this before, that the new kind of terror will likely be drone related. And I compared this attack in Vegas to drones because it was from the sky. It was from above, and it's extra vulnerable in an open, you know, in an open air event. Do you think this is something that could happen more often?
Oh, you know, Greg, that's exactly right. You know, these new technologies empower us. You know, they allow us to find terrorists and to target them with drones, but the new technologies, you're right, also make us more vulnerable because the technologies for a drone are cheap and easily available. And so terrorists can adapt and use them just as well as we can. So you're right. Here in this case, you had basically a classic sniper attack.
Right.
But once you introduce drones or just robotics, our book is a lot about robotics, you could just set up a system where the person's not even in the hotel room. And is remote controlling a sniper rifle from up there. Or, as you said, unfortunately, ISIS has been doing this in the battlefield without much success, but they could just take drones and put hand grenades on them and drop them onto crowds.
Yeah. That's they've been trying to do that, right?
They have actually done it, but they've just not been very successful with it, because on a battlefield where you've got soldiers who are well armed and you have defensive systems, they're not going to be very effective weapons. But against an unarmed civilian crowd, something like a hand grenade dropped from a drone could have, could cause terror. Just the stampede of it could kill people trying to escape.
Well, that's the one thing that, the planning of this event, it seems to me that, I don't know where he was shooting, but if he was shooting up in the front, that could lead to a stampede, and I don't know how many people died from the stampede, but this guy had planned so meticulously, I assume that was part of his whole dream or nightmare. The other thing, too, about the drones, and I read this in The Future of Violence, which Gabriella Bloom wrote it, I think, and it was about the idea of using drones and bioterror, like anthrax, being able to take a drone over a stadium and dropping spores. And it leads me to this question. Are open air events, are they just going to become, are they going to go the way of the dinosaur? People aren't just going to go to these things because they're just vulnerable?
Well, the thing about technology is, yes, you can think of ways where you could use drones to deliver things like biological or chemical weapons. But also keep in mind, drones also, robotics and drones and high-tech sensors also allow us to play a better defense.
Right.
So you can also, you know, if you think about it now, you're already using drones in disaster areas like hurricanes and so on to locate people. You could also have drones play defense and try to detect. So, for example, over the concert site in Las Vegas, this terrible shooting, you know, maybe in the future the police are going to start deploying drones themselves over mm-hmm. these things to more quickly locate someone like this. You know, they took a long time to find
this
guy in the Mandalay Bay Hotel. If you had a series of drones over, and this is one thing that I discovered writing this book, is we think of drones as like basically aircraft without a pilot, but similarly in size, and it shoots a missile. That's not what drones are going to be in the future. They're going to be swarms of like insects.
Mm.
And drones are going to be very cheap, small, and the trick is to operate them in concert. So if you think about an open-air event, you're right, it's going to be more vulnerable, but maybe we can use drones to play defense, to protect the crowds, not just, you know, let terrorists use drones as an offensive weapon.
Yeah, you know, you make a great point in your book. There's a lot of hue and cry over technological advancement in war. The fear is that, you know, somehow it'll make, like, having a highly specific weaponry will make war that much easier. But you make this great point, is that what we're doing is we're just allowing other people, A, to get there first, and B, kind of allowing people with primitive or unconventional means of weaponry to still have an upper hand. Like, if we don't do this, if we don't develop this technology, terrorists will always have an edge on us because of the way they fight. They hide among communities. And the only way we're going to be able to fight them is with these new technologies. Is that fair to say? Or
yes. Greg, I think you put your finger right on it. Is one thing that we found puzzling are all these very well-known people calling for a ban.
Right.
So Elon Musk mm-hmm. and 100 tech CEOs just 2 weeks ago called for a ban on all robotics and AI, artificial intelligence in combat. A few years ago, Stephen Hawking led another letter of thousands of scientists who want to stop the use of these. But as you say, that assumes a utopian world where there's no rivals, there's no enemies, there's no competition.
Mm-hmm.
Russia and China are pouring research and development into this. We've been fighting a low-intensity cyber war with China and Russia for years now. They're eating our lunch. They're totally taking advantage of us. And as you say, terrorist groups, the unconventional fighters, the people, I think they're the worst people on the battlefield, people who disguise themselves as civilians and they attack civilians.
Right.
They're not trying to attack military objects. They want to spread terror in our populations. They're all going to start using this technology whether we decide to do it or not. So I think in this area, the best kind of defense is actually offense. The only way to restrain a Russia and China is to threaten them with retaliation. The only way to stop terrorists from using these technologies against us is to prevent them from ever getting their hands on it in the first place.
Yeah, and it does – when you look at it from that perspective, the people that are calling for a ban of something that hasn't really been used yet – I mean, it has starting to be used, but it's like you talk about it in your book that like war comes first and the law follows. You can't ban something before its use. Has that ever been done? Not even with chemical weapons.
Yeah, but think about, you know, exactly. I mean, this goes back historically, you know, in the Middle Ages,
mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church and the European nobility tried to ban crossbows.
Right.
Because when crossbows came along, that meant any peasant could shoot a knight and, you know, just ruin the old way of fighting. And there was an effort to ban them. But as you say, when you introduce these new technologies, and then World War I, we saw the submarine, the airplane, the tank, chemical, but they were all efforts to ban all of those in the beginning. None of them worked because, as you say, first, when you introduce the weapon, nobody knows the effects. So
right.
Why would some countries that use them to their advantage give it up?
Right.
You know, if you're Germany and you gave up submarines right away, you're just going to say, well, that means Britain gets to run the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
So no country is going to do that. You only do it after you see the effects of the weapons. You see the effect of the balance of power it has. Just take nuclear weapons, the worst weapons that there are. You know, they're introduced at the end of World War II. There's no agreement to limit them until the 1970s, and there's no agreement to actually reduce the large stockpiles until basically the 2000s. Mm-hmm. So it took, you know, between 30 and 40 years after nuclear weapons came along before you can really talk about having a ban.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny when you hear I go back to Elon Musk, and, you know, that he may be sincere, but his argument actually could benefit terrorists by not allowing you to find those specific ways to target the head guy. Because the whole point of what you're talking about is first of all, what devices do you specifically are you talking about? I'm assuming the viewer know, the listener knows, because I've read the book. But what are you primarily talking about? Drones? Or what are the other things?
The three things: robotics. So not just we like to say drones, but we're going to see in the next 10 years an enormous expansion of the use of robots in war, not just in the air, but on the ground, in the sea, and like I said, small swarms of them, not like a robotic battleship.
Right.
But you're going to see like 25 tiny little robotic ships that they're just designed to crash into the enemy. So you're going to see that in robots. Cyber, we're calling for a much broader use of cyber weapons. We think the only way to stop China from, you know, breaking into Equifax or stealing all the government databases or stealing enormous amounts of commercial technology is by retaliation. And then the third one we're talking about is space.
Yeah.
You know, so you actually brought this, you know, important point. You know, these what this murderer did in Las Vegas is he took the high ground and he was using it to shoot down on people. But your broader point was is that the higher you are, the higher ground, the more effective control you have in the military, and the ultimate high ground is space.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that's weird about Elon Musk and all these people, they're not only giving terrorists an advantage, they're giving rogue states like North Korea an advantage, because the way we kind of stop them is through things like aerial drones, space, and anti-missile defense, and better reconnaissance and surveillance. We'd be giving all that up, where we actually have a great advantage right now over Russia or China or North Korea, Iran, or any terrorist group.
No, and it's true. And the other, you know, the other thing too that, you know, they say, okay, these advancements in war are going to make war much easier because they are easier to do, and you could kill less, and you could do it quickly. So you're more likely to make the decision to unleash, let's say, a tiny robot, because you're only going to kill these people. You're not going to drop a giant bomb. But your counter argument is, that actually makes it persuasive. It actually becomes a persuasive tool. In fact, in some ways, it's a better, healthier persuasive tool than, say, sanctions, which hurts an entire population, right?
Yeah, you really do a really good job summarizing the thing I think that bothers a lot of people about drones and cyber, is that they feel like, oh, if American troops aren't at risk, we're just going to start using force against everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a legitimate argument. It gives a lot of people fear. But I think the problem is that we are actually shying away from using force. Think about all the terrible things happening in the world, like the Syrian civil war, the low-level combat we're having with China and Russia, these contests. Or think about North Korea. If you don't use these technologies, we're stuck between bribing North Korea not to use these nuclear weapons or launching an invasion of North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got no steps in between except the economic sanctions.
Right.
So why wouldn't we use these new technologies to pressure a North Korea or pressure an Iran to try to head them off, falling short of an outright full-scale attack?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are just other steps. They're like, they're pinpricks that are effective. And it seems to be part of the negotiating toolkit to have everything like this here. But I think people think, and I'm part of the same group of people. I saw Terminator. The opening scene is, you know,
I did too. I love those movies.
Yes, and in the opening scene when you have all the robots just bunch around. That's what this is a different argument. This is when AI becomes self-aware, and AI will, and there are people like Elon Musk and Sam Harris, a few other people who believe strongly that this is a big concern, that AI, the recursive self-improvement, becoming self-aware will turn all of us into barnyard animals. We will be, you know, they'll be the farmers and we'll be the barnyard animals. And is there a legitimate fear to that? And should that fear play a role when you're discussing this kind of weaponry?
Yeah, this is you're right, exactly right, Greg. That is like a big, it's a different argument. I think that's the big fear looming behind everything. You know, partially I blame James Cameron for being too good a director.
Yeah, no, he was way ahead of it.
Movies. Yeah, and so like I think a lot of this been conditioned to this fear. Well, if we ever create these kind of robots with intelligence, they're just going to take over.
Right.
So, you know, one thing is, like, why would the robots want to run this terrible place? Like, do they really want to be in charge? It's like, do they want to be the manager of a Denny's?
That's interesting.
If they're so powerful and gifted, why would they want to run, you know, humanity?
But the thing is, okay, but if you, like, what's interesting about that point is they're a kind of thinking, which is, I guess, not, you could say, non-conscious thinking or whatever you want to call it. They wouldn't even address that question if they had one goal in mind, and this is like the Nick Bostrom, you know, theory, like if they're supposed to count paperclips, they will kill everybody on the planet to count the paperclips. So it's like they're not even thinking like they're not thinking about it like a Denny's. They're just they're goal oriented. And what could happen is if one of these things, these drones become so goal oriented and they don't know when to stop, like let's say you program a drone to do a specific thing, but it wants to be better at it. So it just keeps.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
So I think one thing is, in a funny way, there's no evidence that this will happen.
Right.
It's never happened yet. You know, none of these, like the Deep Blue IBM computer that wins a chess isn't suddenly trying to take over the world or take over even other games. You know, like he's not trying to win Scrabble now. So in a funny way, it's like we are anthropomorphized. We're projecting onto the robots what we worry about human beings would do.
Yes, it's like me thinking that my toaster is going to steal my wallet.
Exactly. But the second point is, this is a level of programming and computers so far advanced beyond anything we can do now. So, again, take the chess-playing computer. So a lot of people read that finally a computer program won this ancient Japanese game called Go, which people thought would take a long time. And, you know, people are a little worried because the Go program actually came up with strategies no human being had ever used before. So people are like, oh, this is – but you know what? The Go program can't play chess.
Right.
Like any kid can actually learn one game and apply it to another game. But actually these programs are not so – can't do things that even a five-year-old can do in a lot of ways. And so this fear is talking about things that might happen – long, long time in the future, if ever. People are not even sure yet whether we can ever design a computer program that can do something equivalent to what an average human mind can do. But second, it's a fear, right?
Yeah.
It's a far off fear. Is it really worth giving up, as you said, point out these many benefits of these kinds of weapons, their precision. They reduce casualties. They kill less people. We may not go to full-blown war as often. You know, we could think of a solution to Iran and North Korea that doesn't require us to go to nuclear war. Should we give all that up because we're worried that 500 years from now, robots are going to take over?
By the way, that's the same argument that one would have used like in any – like why would we give up something, any kind of new technology, like the internet? Like you could say in the 1940s or whatever, or 1950s, there's this emerging thing, but my God, it could be used for anything. We better not use it. Maybe that's a different example, but it's technology that might – well, automobiles. You could say that about automobiles. Yep. These things – and boy, that didn't stop people, 60,000 people that die every year. It didn't stop them. It doesn't stop people with prescription medications. It doesn't stop them with firearms. My concern is – well, actually, I was going to point out that maybe AI has already achieved self-awareness. It's just playing dumb.
Just waiting.
Just waiting, waiting until the time is right. You know, I'm on your side on this, these kind of weapons and having every kind of potential advantage and being there first. Because if you're there second, it doesn't matter. And I think America has shown that. Like, if you're there first on something, you rule. And my biggest concern, and you mentioned it in the book, Islamic terrorism. Now, their deal, their promise for a terrorist, a jihadist, is to kill as many people because that speeds your way to heaven. So there's no negotiation with a martyr. You can't talk a martyr out of martyrdom, because where they're going is way better than hanging around with you. So
yes.
My feeling is, if the world were to end, it's going to be a martyr with a dirty bomb, or a martyr with some kind of massive destructive device. I don't know. How do we stop that? And is that
That's
kind of what
point.
This book is about?
Yes, the part of the book is about this problem, because the way we would solve this, if it was, say, even in Iran or North Korea, Russia, China, certainly, another nation, we use deterrence.
Yeah.
You know, these weapons, cyber, even nuclear, offense is cheap. It's easy to attack. Defense is expensive. When that's true, you have to rely on deterrence. That's the only way to get the other side to stop. Your point is right, is that for these jihadists, deterrence doesn't work because they want to die.
Right.
Right. There's no way to. So the only thing, and this, you know, this is what I've thought ever since, you know, I was in the Bush administration on 9/11. Prevention is the only thing that's going to work. You can't rely on deterrence. So the way to think about this is, you got to use these new technologies in a way that allow us to be better at prevention. And part of that is using the internet to detect and find these people, especially once ISIS loses its territory and all these foreign fighters return home.
Right.
They're going to go to Europe first. A lot of them have European passports. They're going to use those to get into America. As you say, they have the capability to build more destructive weapons. So we have to use a lot of these technologies to be able to detect them, find them first, and stop them before they get here. Once they get inside the country, then, I mean, we have a, you know, we're a country that's open.
Right.
And part of the cost of being open is that it's easy for people to carry out something that happened in Las Vegas.
Exactly. And that's I think about that. I think about that all the time. And I think, you know, with these kind of weapons, I say, you know, we get there first and then we will talk. And we have and we have – this is the earth is a battlefield right now with Islamic jihadism. And if, you know, we have to throw the kitchen sink at this. So I'm this is the modern kitchen sink. So Dr. Hugh, Professor Hugh, I almost called you Dr. Hugh, which I guess I could, but I think I'll call you Professor Hugh. The book is called Striking Power: How Cyber, Robots, and Space Weapons Change the Rules for War. Really a good read, and it's good talking to you. I appreciate the time you gave me, and I hope to get you on our show one of these days as well.
Greg, anytime. I really love it. I'm a fan of the show. I'd be happy to be on anytime you like. Thanks so much for giving me a chance.
Excellent, Professor. And it's also the co-author's Jeremy Rabkin. I don't want to leave him out. I know who co-authors get very upset about that. Take care, Professor.
Okay, you too.